Welcome to the criminal part, all you criminal folks. Let's start with House Bill 10, sex offense amendments. It's always a good place to start. House Bill 10, Representative Greenwood was interested in the unlawful sexual conduct with 16 or 17 year olds. We've had a 10-year difference for quite a number of years between the perpetrator and the minor. And he wanted to change that from 10 years to 7 years. So we started looking at it, and it was very interesting. Am I still wired? Yeah, okay. Yeah, everyone, of course, thought that mistake of age was not a defense in the unlawful sexual conduct of the 16 or 17-year-old. Well, as it turns out, when we're in the process of arguing about this thing, the defense attorneys are talking to the sponsor and saying, well, you know, here's the problem. It's going to be, if you take it down to 7 years, you've got a real problem because mistake of age is no defense, you know, and there's just not that much age difference between these folks. And so we started looking at the statute carefully, and we realized that the unlawful sexual conduct with 16 and 17-year-olds is not listed in the part of the code that says making that mistake of age is not a defense. In other words, it's not. It's not strict liability. So now we had a real problem. We had to do something about it. We couldn't let the bill not go through at that point because the defense attorneys were onto that one. So that left us with a problem. And yet people were still uncomfortable with the 7 year difference. So now this is sausage making at its best, by the way. So now what we have because of HB 10, and it was effective March 22nd, by the way, 2013. We asked for an accelerated effective date rather than the usual May 14th. And the reason for that was because everybody was onto this problem. So we thought, well, we better fix it as fast as we can. So now, if you have a 10-year age difference, it's strict liability as to the age of the minor. And if you're going with a 7 year difference, the standard is knew or reasonably should have known the minor's age. Rather interesting.
Yes, indeed. Smoking with passenger under 15 years old, HB 13. A couple of things to point out here real quick. One is that this is a secondary offense, officers, so it's not something to actually stop the vehicle for. The second thing is it has kind of it has a semi-effective date and then a real effective date. The semi is the fact that it will become statute this year, but the time when you can start issuing citations for it, as you'll see there, is July 1 of 2014. So essentially you have a one-year break-in period where if you see somebody smoking with a 15-year-old or somebody younger than 15 in the car, you have to issue them a warning during that year period. And the other thing is if the vehicle is a convertible or open body type and the roof is open air, then you can smoke with that child in the vehicle. And the only sad part about that is I think we may have more children getting colds, but at least no secondhand smoke.
Well, there you go. House Bill 27, threat of terrorism penalty. Last time this section was revised, accidentally there was a penalty left out. And the Supreme Court, the appellate court anyway, one of them, very congenially inserted a penalty in one of the appellate opinions. And so actually what we've done here in HB 27 is to conform it to the way the appellate courts were reading it. And that is if you have one of the residual violations, which is where you make a false threat, and it's just barely enough to make somebody take make some agency do something about it, then it's a Class B misdemeanor. And also the standard has changed a little bit, and that's to make an agency take action due to the person's conduct posing a serious and substantial risk to the general public. So it was a little bit of a close call before. So that gets rid of the de minimis cases.
I'm going to kind of backtrack real quick and look briefly at HB 19. And what I'm going to say about this is we're going to see five or six of these bills, and I think I'll just use the term ditto bill in the sense of what it's doing. On election code criminal provisions, this is just a kind of an offbeat part of the code, criminal code, where the Sentencing Commission has gone through the code in a number of places to fix kind of just crazy sentencing schemes that have been in existence. This is a good example. You'll see the struck language that's there. It used to be a 2 to 10 year penalty, and we don't really have that anymore. And so all of these bills are just making it a standard third degree felony or whatever the case might be. HB 28, campus safety amendments, really just does two main things that I'll point out. One of those is it fixed some inconsistent sections, made it a Class B misdemeanor to trespass on property that's owned, operated, or controlled by an institution of higher education, and then it clarified the notice requirement that would need to be given before that could ever be cited, what constitutes notice, that kind of thing. And then it also specifies, importantly, the bill says that mere carrying or possession of a firearm on the campus does not warrant an order to leave in and of itself if the person is otherwise complying with all state law. And I think we can imagine some scenarios where that's happened even in the news, and so that was brought forward to address that situation.
Okay, House Bill 31 has to do with enticing a minor. This came the concern for this, and in fact, the momentum to run this bill started in Cache County. Spencer Walsh, I don't know if Spencer's here or not, anyway, was particularly excited about this, and as was James Swink, his boss, and so they recruited Representative Webb to fix this enticing statute. And it was something that needed fixing because as it was drafted originally, the idea was for someone who was enticing a minor over the internet for the crime to be completed at the keyboard. That was really the idea. You do do this enticement, and then you don't have to prove that they were actually intending to follow through with committing one of these sexual crimes against the minor. Of course, if they set a date to meet them and they show up, then at that point you're getting fairly close to an attempt, which would have a higher penalty, would have a first degree penalty. So, but there was a problem in there, and that is that the subsection that says what the penalties are, it says that if they entice the minor with the intent to commit, and then it has the rest of it, and intent to commit was put in there really just as a reference to the level of the crime. It wasn't really intended to add an additional mens rea. But, you know, that's the way it looked. So it caused a real problem, and there was varying interpretation around the state. So we ran a bill that had the tick out the intent to commit part so that you don't have an extra mens rea, but you still do have the mens rea that they were attempting essentially to groom these kids for the purpose of committing sex crimes against them. You know, and that's essentially what the problem is. The harm is done not just in saying something dirty on the internet, but in talking with these kids and enticing them so that you're kind of grooming them into something that they wouldn't otherwise be doing. And that is, that's why that's a second degree felony. It's pretty serious stuff. So this got a lot of scrutiny. Sentencing Commission argued it back and forth and looked at it and finally went with supporting it. So yeah, it worked out fine, but that's one of these delicate balance issues. And a lot of the issues that were raised were certainly legitimate. So that's where we are. Next, we have House Bill 33. This was the expungement bill. Last year, Senator Howard Stevenson ran ran a bill having to do with drug expungement of drug-related offenses, and this really was just the most wide-open thing you've ever seen. It would have, had it passed, it would have said, well, if anything's drug-related, you can expunge it. It was just kind of a mishmash. It was a real problem. So we went to Senator Stevenson last year and said, well, look, why don't we study this thing, and we're serious about it, we'll really study it, we'll work on it, but we cannot possibly live with what you're talking about, because this is just expunging things left and right without any sense, just because they have something to do with it. So we had a drug-related expungement committee. Scott Reed chaired it, and we had James Swink and I were on it, and it was staffed by CCJJ, and it was a pretty good committee, but it took a lot, and we had a lot of warm, fuzzy people on it from the treatment standpoint. And a lot of people came up and talked about this thing and said, well, look, you know, we have a real problem with people who run up a bunch of criminal convictions, and then they turn their life around, they get their drug problems under control, and they keep it that way for several years, but they're still, because of their past records, having a very difficult time getting employment and getting things straightened out. And the fact of the matter is, it was a legitimate issue. And of course, none of us as prosecutors really want to be in a situation where people can't turn their lives around. We just, it's just that when they're faking it, we want them to be responsible for it. So it's always an interesting concept. Well, anyway, so we ran, what I failed to mention was that last year, Senator Stevenson had a rally in the rotunda, and he got up and quoted Victor Hugo's Les Miserables, and read the whole thing about the bishop's candlestick and forgiving Jean Valjean and buying his soul and that kind of thing. And boy, it was really great. And those of us who were looking at the words in the bill were just going, ah, now what are we going to do? So anyway, this led to some really, to some great competition for who had really the best Jean Valjean bill. And so Chad and I have decided that that the theme for this legislative session was Leg Miserable. And buying right into that, of course, was Senator Thatcher, who had a theft bill. And so he got up on the floor last year, and this carried over for 2 years, really, and said, well, this is the real Jean Valjean bill, because people who have, who steal just enough. No, that's a different bill.
Is that too early?
This is the best Jean Valjean. Just gets you, doesn't it? This is the best Jean Valjean bill, because people who steal bread for their to keep their nephew alive or their niece alive, for and they do it three times, they're going to go to prison. You know, it's just awful. So anyway, that competition just kind of went on. So the theft bill was very interesting, and I'm talking about a bill that didn't pass, but we have to talk about it because we spent months on this thing, and in the end it didn't pass. But we what happened is we redrafted the theft bill that came up last year, which would have changed the penalties on repeat theft offenders. And we made it so it was kind of complicated, but it worked out so that it took advantage of the fact that increasing penalties step by step does seem to have some effect on recidivism. That if you can tell a person who commits a crime that next time it's going to be a little bit worse, it does seem to keep the recidivism rate going down. We didn't really know that until we did this study and looked at all the theft cases at the prison, and and through the state. So it was some very interesting stuff. But that bill, even though we thought it was okay, ended up getting killed at the end of the session just because they ran out of time. Now, Senator Thatcher told me that what happened is when it got on the bill in the House, it had passed the Senate. When it got on the calendar in the House on the last day, that the Speaker didn't really want the bill that was coming after it, and so she ended the session 15 minutes early. And he didn't feel very good about it. So that fits right into our theme of Speaker of the House, sponsor from the Senate, said his bill would pass if he had one more minute.
Speaker of the House,
said his bill would pass if he had one more minute. But anyway, it didn't
very
work.
Very good.
So that was...
Come on, really, folks, I mean...
Anyhow, back to the expungement bill. What we've
was that from? Was that cassette?
No, it was on a DVD.
Oh.
So we had to work on that timing. So the things that what we ended up with on the expungement bill, and this is fairly serious stuff. We ended up with three separate things. First of all, the Board of Pardons. If things don't fit right into the expungement category, then the Board of Pardons has of course authority to issue pardons. And when they issue a pardon, what has been happening up to now is still those records weren't expunged unless somebody went through the court process. So the first thing that happened was that this allowed the Board of Pardons to directly issue expungement orders, and they have the same effect as expungement orders which are issued by the court. Okay, good idea. Now the only thing that we have to be sure about at this point as prosecutors is we want to make sure that we're paying attention to notices that are sent out by the Board of Pardons, and so this may be things that we'll have to work out a little bit with the board, but I'm sure that we can do it to make sure that we get input on those cases before the pardon happens. So we'll see about that, but we're pretty sure it'll work. The next thing is that rather than having drug-related offenses, what we put in there was drug possession offenses. And this was a lot of work, but finally we got the whole committee to go along with this, that you can expunge what you could expunge before, but in addition to that, you can expunge a couple of drug possession offenses. And then we defined that as pretty much any drug possession offense, except for the obvious ones like 100 pounds of marijuana and those kinds of things that are intended to really look at distribution without having to prove somebody intended to distribute. In the summary here, I think that I've got a little bit of a misprint here. Where it says the applicant may be eligible to expunge three or more felonies. I think what that is if they have three felonies, they can't do it. The way that section is structured, it has it has the number of crimes that you may not expunge, so you have to get in and count it. I won't go into the detail because it's a little confusing to explain it. And besides that, Lana Taylor is here, and if you have a real question, you can ask Lana about it. I don't suggest calling her any day, any time, day or night, but, you know, she's very helpful, and she's counsel for BCI, and she actually understands how those things work. Well, what's next, Chad?
HB 50, Dating Violence Protective Order Act, which is bill that has been... It's actually been run a number of times, but it has never passed until this year. Maybe that it had the right sponsor, whatever the reason might be. But the good news about this that I'll say, of course, it's an important issue, and anything you can do to prevent violence in those kind of relationships is important. But ladies, if you've ever had a define the relationship kind of talk, now you can actually pull out the code and help out with that define the relationship talk, because it has a definition for whether or not you are in a dating relationship. And I'd just like to point out that includes a social relationship of a romantic or intimate nature, or relationship which has romance or intimacy as a goal by one or both parties. So really it just takes one to be in a dating relationship. And I think under that definition, most of the men in here are generally in a dating relationship at any given time. But of course it does some important things.
Well, that means that he's dating, but only on his own.
That, yeah, wow, it's amazing, isn't it? I just wanted to let that sink in for a moment. So, again, this is essentially setting up the same procedures that you have with a cohabitant type dating. Oh, not cohabitant dating. Those don't go together. In fact, the bill points that out. Says if you are a cohabitant, you cannot be in a dating relationship. And my guess is most marriage people would say that's exactly the truth. Sorry.
Bitter.
But a couple of interesting things. That protective order will stay in place for 180 days, unless it otherwise goes away. But it's a pretty long period. It's longer than the period for regular protective orders. And something else I point out, just to be aware of, especially if you're law enforcement, this is an entirely enacted new part of the code, an interesting thing. It allows a family member of a person that's in a dating relationship in that home to apply for that dating relationship protective order. So be aware of that as well. It's good to know whether you're dating or not. Criminal substances, I should touch on that real quick. HB 52, we'll actually see two of these. This was Representative Ray. We're always trying to keep up with the most current chemical compound names that are in the listed Substance Act, which was enacted, I think, just last year. Was that just last year you did that? I think so. In other words, we're talking about spice, and we're talking about bath salts, those kind of things. But of course, you need to be able to name what those substances are in their chemical structure. You'll see AM-2233 here, AKB-48. There's always something new coming out. We try to stay ahead of that. There's still a possibility of, they're still looking at a possibility of a special session always, if that becomes necessary. But at least we're trying to keep up with the criminals out there, the chemist criminals.
76.
Me? 76 is you.
Well, House Bill 76, now this was vetoed. It was a very interesting deal. This was, you may have heard that this started as some people concerned about cowboys out in Uinta County not being able to put a raincoat over their weapons as they were riding around on the range if they didn't have a concealed weapon license. You may have heard that rumor that that's how this started. I am here to verify that's absolutely true. And of course it became a cause celeb for everybody. It was started by Representative Mathis from Uinta County, who I think probably gets the miscongeniality award for the entire legislature. Wouldn't you say, Susan? Probably one of the nicest guys we know, but this idea really kind of went sideways on him, and so the governor ended up having to veto it. We won't get into all of it, but I would say that when you're talking about a self-protection issue, rather than go with that, I'd go with Steve's slide that says, "Do not grow a hand in a dolphin fence." Enough said.
HB 83 is speed limit amendments. I just really like this bill. That's because I do like to drive fast, and it makes a difference. I'll point out that under this bill, you can go to Wendover much faster now, and so you can lose your money faster. And then it's expanded even on I-15, those periods where you get those 80 mile per hour speed limits. So if you're one of those type of people that likes to go to Las Vegas, maybe make frequent trips to visit girls with the name of Kelsey or something like that. That was actually for Mr. Scott, who may or may not be in this room, but anyway, it's a good bill for those that like to drive fast. And attempted aggravated murder amendments.
Boy, talk about an end joke.
Well, yeah, I happen to know he
anyway,
makes those
okay.
frequent Excuse trips. HB 87 is attempted aggravated murder amendments. And this, of course, it addresses a specific case and an especially vicious attack that happened down in Utah County, which was an attempted aggravated murder. And the reason for this bill is that you want to have parity in the criminal structure, in the criminal penalty structure. And attempted aggravated murder where there's serious bodily injury, and that's what this is getting at, should have the higher penalty. So this sets up a 15 to life as the base penalty for the judge, 15 years to life on an attempted aggravated murder. The judge can depart from that and go downward for a good reason, but the base penalty is 15 years to life.
HB 92, the factual innocence amendments. up to now, the spouse has had no survivor benefits. for those of you who have had to deal with these cases, particularly Pat Nolan, the AG's office, and his successor in interest. So anyway, now the spouse must have the spouse has survival benefits, but only if they were married to the wrongfully convicted person at the time that they were convicted. So they can't. Well, anyway, you understand the policy reasons behind that, and they have remained continuously married until the wrongfully convicted person passes away, and the payments cease on the death of the spouse. House Bill 93, Traffic Violations Amendments, is an interesting one. This is a problem which has gone for a long time, and that is if you have a misdemeanor violation and then you have another maybe misdemeanor or even felony violation that's more serious, what do you do about that? If you have somebody who pleads to a DUI, and for instance, and there is a serious bodily injury, but nobody knows about it, and so the person goes in and actually pleads to the DUI. Now, Laura was talking about this yesterday when you have separate crimes, but what happens if you have the same crime and it's actually accelerated because you have the serious bodily injury? What kind of problems do you end up with on an single criminal episode issue, yes. but anyway, so it's actually the same crime. So what do you do about that? Well, the idea here is that if there is serious bodily injury, that the court may not accept a plea of guilty to a regular DUI. Now, how is the court supposed to know? Well, the peace officer needs to put that on the citation so that they're put on the citation that there is serious bodily injury or death resulted or may have resulted from this injury. So at that point, then the courts are prohibited from accepting a plea to the DUI until that whole thing is straightened out. This is what we have done on DUIs as far as the prosecutor having to have a look at it for priors. And so that seems to have worked reasonably well. So we kind of copied that issue. So anyway, keep that in mind, city prosecutors and police officers, that we want to avoid that ever happening again. And so make sure that is on the citation if there is serious bodily injury. That's going to be added into the forms, as I recall.
HB 102 is arson penalty amendments. Jeff Hall in Salt Lake DA's office helped out a lot with this and brought the issue forward. And what's been happening is you have some firebugs out there, and there was one specifically that was spoken about at the committee hearing and that really prompted this, where just likes to watch people put out the fires he starts. Not really, in his mind, maybe trying to cause a lot of damage, and yet you have him doing this any time he gets released from custody. So what this bill does is it sets up essentially the kind of penalty structure that you have with the theft statute, and so you can see it on the top of page 16 there. But the point of it is if you get to a point where they have a prior conviction within 10 years, you can then have a higher penalty, a one-step higher penalty for causing that fire. And then you'll see the penalties, which essentially match theft. HB 103 is wireless telephone use restrictions. Officers, this will be for 16, 17-year-olds. In other words, if you're younger than 18, you're driving in your vehicle, you can't use your phone. The exceptions that are provided there make sense. You're reporting a safety hazard, or you're requesting assistance, or reporting criminal activity, or if you're communicating with a parent or guardian. So practice tip I'd have for this for the police officers is if you stop them for something and you stop them for using their phone and 16, 17-year-old, try and make a point of asking if they can see their recent cell phone history, whether it's a placed call or a received call. The most recent one should be the one that they were doing there. Ask them who they were talking to. Because if they have a built-in defense, well, then that's going to make the prosecution difficult. Wireless call location information is at HB 104. And I'll mention a couple things. This is actually a really interesting bill and deserves a little bit of attention both by prosecutors and law enforcement. The intent of this bill is really to try and foster a little bit more cooperation between the telephone companies who have cell site location information that they can provide to law enforcement immediately. They could really do it immediately as long as they're willing to do it immediately. And the purpose of this bill is to have and require those telephone communication companies to set up the procedures that they will use to provide that information immediately to you on a voluntary basis if you, as the law enforcement officer, tell them that it is because of the risk, an immediate risk of death or serious bodily injury. And this is a national push that's happening. In fact, we're, I think, the 10th state to adopt this law. And it comes out of just a terrible incident. There was a girl named Kelsey Smith who, she had been abducted. This was in Kansas several years ago. Verizon Wireless, the phone pinged, and Verizon Wireless knew where the ping was happening, but they just wouldn't provide the information. They waited 3.5 days to provide it. Within an hour of providing it, they had found her body, and of course, by that time, she was dead. And so after that, the Kelsey Smith Foundation was started, and they tried to get these laws passed. It has nothing to do with a court order. You can obviously go and get a court order, and they have to obey that. But the purpose of this is try and get that information faster for law enforcement.
House Bill 105 is a serious youth offender. This is another one that we spent a lot of committee time over the course of the year. This goes way back to, a mere drop in the bucket to 1995 when we had, under State versus Mohi, the the direct file provisions were being brought into question. And so what happened at that time is we basically, in anticipation of the Mohi case, and by the way, we were correct, in anticipation of that, we came up with the procedure for the Serious Youth Offender Act. And anybody who doesn't know what this is a way for youthful offenders to be transferred to the adult system to be tried as adults. Now, there are, of course, problems with trying juveniles as adults, or we wouldn't have a juvenile system. I mean, duh. But the problem is when you have extremely serious cases, sometimes you're just not going to have enough time to hold them in the juvenile system. And so this has been a problem that has happened nationwide. Back in Back at that time, everybody was saying, let's get tough, and we want to get as many of them out of the juvenile system, get the bad apples out of there, and let's try them adults. And everybody was saying adult time for adult crime, that kind of thing. Unfortunately, what has happened has been really kind of a mixed bag. With some of them, of course, they need to be locked up for a long time. The difficulty there is that if you get a minor in the state prison, they're going to be in administrative segregation, which is a nice way to say solitary confinement, because what else can they do with them? And this, of course, is the time when their brains are doing some crucial development, which, you know, just still hasn't happened yet. And so they come, you just make sure that they're the worst possible criminals when they're in that kind of a situation. The other thing is, you get a lot of them who, when a district court judge looks at sentencing issues, this is not the worst criminal on his calendar because he's so young, and they'll say, well, you know, they want to put him on probation. We don't have specialized probation officers in the adult system to deal with juveniles, and so they really don't get the kind of supervision that we really ought to be giving them. So it does cause a pretty serious problem. Nationwide, the way that they've been dealing with this is there have been several different varieties of what's called blended sentencing, so that once somebody is transferred to the adult system, they still have a way of using resources from the juvenile system. And so that's something that we've been interested in exploring. In Salt Lake County, we've had a number of cases where we had wished that we had blended sentencing, and in a couple of cases, we've actually been able to kind of fake blended sentencing because we had still had some juvenile cases and adult cases that we were able to work with separately. That's a little precarious, so we're still trying to work on that, and there, we will be working on it again for the next year. However, the big issue that's been coming up for the last 18 years that I know of is the retention factors for whether these serious youth offenders are to be kept in the juvenile system. It was very interesting when we put serious youth offender together. we came up with the idea of, okay, we'll have the preliminary hearing in juvenile court, and then after the judge finds probable cause, then the judge will decide whether this goes on to the adult court or whether it stays in the juvenile court, and we'll have some factors that they consider. And we came up with, I did this list of factors to be considered under that circumstance, and then we basically said to the Board of Juvenile Judges, so what kind of factors do you think are important? They came up with the current list, which left most of us kind of flabbergasted because it was so strict that you almost couldn't meet them, and I guess part of that was the fact that the juvenile court judges were really under fire at that time. Because of the way things are going anyway, you know, politics is politics. So anyway, so we started working with that. Well, so for a number of years, I think there were like 68 in the first year that were transferred from the juvenile court to the adult court. You go up 18 years and juvenile crime has gone down a little bit. but I think but not to this degree, and we had, I think it was 10 total that were transferred into the adult court this last year. And most of that has been because the prosecutors have been pretty introspective about the cases that they have been filing as serious youth offender, because the factors are so close that basically this decision has been put onto the prosecutors. It's a decision that probably should be made by the courts, but now that the prosecutors have been making it for a while, you know, we're kind of loath to give it up. because nobody likes to give up their own discretion. So it's been kind of a push-pull kind of issue. We've talked about it a lot with your elected prosecutors, and pretty much went along with the ideas that came up by the committee of the subcommittee of the Sentencing Commission, which studied the issue. So this brings us to the next thing, and that is what do we use as retention factors? Because we still want them to be pretty darn strong, because it's very important that that we consider public safety, because public confidence in the criminal justice system is still really a big deal. So you can't just say, well, gee, what's the best thing to do with this kid? Because a lot of times they're a real danger to the community. So anyway, so the factors that we ended up negotiating, and I'll tell you, nobody had, a lot of people wanted to simply get rid of serious youth offender and go back entirely to to certification. Well, we didn't think that was the best idea, and we didn't think that was going to work. So the retention factors that we came up with essentially are that the court must find that it's contrary to the best interest of the minor and to the public to bind over the defendant to the jurisdiction of the district court. And now, in making the determination, the judge shall consider, and this is one the committee came up with, and frankly, I didn't see coming, and I thought it was pretty good. The judge shall consider only whether the minor's the minor's been previously adjudicated for dangerous weapon offense, greater or lesser culpability than co-defendants, and the extent to which the minor's role was committed in a violent, aggressive, or premeditated manner. The current standard says that they have to find that it wasn't violent, premeditated, et cetera. And of course, if it's one of those serious youth offender crimes, they really can't do it without being violent, because that's the definition of the crimes. So anyway, so they have to consider these. But remember that this is a finding by clear and convincing evidence, and the burden of persuasion is on the defendant to say that they should be retained. And the defendant also has the burden of going forward. I don't know what we can do to stack the standard any better than that. That's pretty much it. There was some suggestion that, well, we might be able to move this decision to the district court and let the district court decide it looking the other way. But the fact of the matter is, they don't know them, wouldn't know these particular cases that well, and district court judges are no more excited to be getting them than the juvenile court judges are to be sending them. So that didn't happen. And so that's where we are. Now, the one consideration that we have, and this is a little caveat to this whole bill, is that we understand that juvenile court judges are not ever closing the retention part of the hearings on serious youth offender, essentially for the purpose of avoiding public input. Now, if we have any cases where that does happen, where you think that the juvenile court judges are closing it just so that they don't get any public input, we want to know about it. But what we understand is that just isn't happening. But the rules do allow the juvenile court judge to close it to spectators, if you have which is probably more useful to us if you have a particularly fragile victim or something like that. There are some other things. So we want continued feedback on this. This may or may not be a work in progress, but certainly the blended sentencing is something we're still going to be pursuing. So that was a lot of history, but those of you who work in this area, this is an important thing, and I really wanted to make sure that you understood why it turned out the way it did.
HB 108 is metal theft amendments. And I guess the most important thing to point out here is if you're going to be screening a case involving metal theft, or if you're law enforcement that is part of the enforcement of these provisions of what secondhand metal dealers have to do. Be aware that the numbering has changed. And so formerly this was all in the 7610-900 range. Now the regulation is going to be at 7661400, new section, and then the enforcement will be at 7610-3000 range. So that's a change. Otherwise, what it does is it adds some new things that metal dealers have to do. They've always had to take a photograph and get a signature, but now it requires that they do it every single time on repeat metal dealer folks or folks that bring in metals. It also adds an enhancement if they've been violated for these sections before, looking at 766, 1407, and 1408, you can look at those. So just be aware of those changes, especially if you're going to be in that part of the law, whether screening or law enforcement. HB 121, next page over, is a firearm safe harbor. The beginning of that, I wrote this little thing, and I used to, of course, watch Sesame Street. Who didn't? And I remember that it was always one of these kids is doing their own thing. And that really was what came to mind when I read and I watched the firearm safe harbor bill go through the session. And there were a lot of firearm bills this year, but this one really was doing its own thing. It's fairly novel. If you're law enforcement, it's something that you have to be aware of, because it could very well happen that somebody just comes marching down to your police station and says, here, take this shotgun. And you might think, well, why is this happening? And this tells you what procedures are, what do you do with that shotgun, what you're allowed to ask that person, what you're allowed to document, and what you have to do with those documents if you return that weapon later. So looking at a few of those things, there's a definition here for an owner cohabitant. So that's interesting, and what that says is that, you know, if this firearm was bought during the course of a marriage, then both of them have ownership to that firearm. Either of them can bring it into the to the police department. Of course, what we're trying to prevent here are really dangerous situations and really tragic situations. And when, if you listen to the committee hearing on this, it was really interesting what they were getting at. And these are real life situations. Life is hard. You know, it's difficult. And the sponsor of the bill talked about the fact that, you know, you have pastors out there, priests, bishops, who have members of their congregation that come and say, listen, my son yesterday said that he just can't handle life anymore, and he doesn't know what he's going to do next. Can you please take this gun and just hold on to it? And so right now this is happening, but you have maybe the inappropriate person that's being asked to take possession of this weapon. And so this is trying to address those real life situations. Now, as the police officer or the police agency, note that you can't assume that somebody should bring a weapon in. It has to happen at the station. They're going to bring it in voluntarily. At that point, you'll record the serial number. You do these record general data, and then you're going to hold the firearm for 60 days in your safe custody. And then you can return it earlier to the cohabitant owner that requested, if it's requested earlier than the 60 days, or return it to another owner if requested, and if it's permissible under Section 202, and then it kind of steps you through that section. So obviously you could have a situation where one person brings in the gun, and then the other co-owner comes in and says, hey, I want my gun back. Well, what do you do in that situation? That's where you jump down to Section 202 that spells out what you would do as the law enforcement agency there. I put there in bold letters, important, and an agency may not do A, B, or C. Well, A, B, or C is appropriate the gun to public interest use. You can't just take it and use it for your own law enforcement purposes because they brought it in. You can't sell the firearm and appropriate the funds of it, and you can't destroy it if unfit for resale until a full year has passed after, you know, everything's settled down. Is kind of the best way to look at that. The other part here, I said a law enforcement agency, looking at this other part that says important up above, a law enforcement agency may not request or require that the owner cohabitant provide the name or other information of the cohabitant who poses an immediate threat or any other cohabitant. That's important. Your natural inclination would say, well, tell me about what's happening here, And I need you to tell me who's the danger in your home. This says you can't do that. And so I kind of jokingly said, this is Utah's own don't ask, don't tell policy. But we'll see it one more time. Well, Utah has a certain relationship with its guns. It likes its guns. And they want to protect any information related to that relationship. They say as much as 10% of the population is in a committed gun relationship here in Utah. But anyway,
it's a lot higher than that.
It may be a little higher than that. Yeah. And looking down, I'm trying to do this quickly, but it's certainly something for law enforcement to be aware of. But there is a point for prosecutors to be aware of, and this is a little bit unusual as well. Looking at the bottom there, when it says finally, paragraph 4, the law enforcement agency shall return a firearm to a person other than an owner who claims ownership if, and this is that section 202, the 60-day has expired, the person provides identification, and the person signs a document attesting that the person has an ownership interest in the firearm. It basically says you give it back if the 60 days is expired, and they just sign a document that says it's mine. Well, that's only one way of them to get back the firearm. The other way is for them to petition to the court. And if they do petition to the court, you as a prosecutor now have to get involved. There's no charges out there. Nothing happened with the criminal case. But it imposes on you to be the overseer of the event at that point. And it states that sufficient notice would go to the prosecutor. And then the prosecutor becomes involved in a determination of whether that gun ought to go back. So there is an obligation with this for both law enforcement and prosecutors. Overall, I think it's a good idea. Obviously, there's a good reason for this bill to exist, but it certainly is unusual.
House Bill 127, Motor Vehicle Event Data Recorders. These event data recorders are being installed in modern manufactured vehicles, and they have, when there is an accident, a collision, it tells whether the airbag deployed, speed, steering performance, brakes, that kind of stuff. And it is, and there are federal regulations on this, which is part of the reason that they have them in the first place. But anyway, so what this was talking about is trying to limit the use of event data recorders. And again, this is part of the big privacy concern, which is just a huge thing with the legislature right now. There is a really anti-Big Brother, anti-government, anti-blah, blah, blah. You've all heard it. You've seen it in your juries, that kind of business. There's a lot of distrust of government. And it makes it a little difficult for prosecutors and police officers to function these days to some degree. But anyway, that's the way it is. And this one is another one that's just kind of symptomatic of that. There were four or five different bills on privacy issues this year alone, and they come up every year. As far as the limitations there are on these event data recorders, what I'll do is just explain what you can use them for. Sandy Johnson was concerned about this bill and made us aware of a number of the specific issues here, which we appreciate. First of all, of course, if you get a court order, you can get the event data recorder, which is a pretty good idea. Now, we can use a search warrant to get them if you happen to have a case where this is important. And for police officers, that's something you want to keep in mind. The safest thing is to go get a search warrant before you get this event data recorder if it appears that there is a criminal problem and you're investigating what happened in this particular collision. The other thing is we had to be very cautious to make sure that we would be able to give these to the other side if we were required to do so as a subject of discovery. So because of the changes which were made, we were able to get those changes made. Again, thanks to Sandy pointing them out to us. We're a little slow sometimes, so you know, anytime you see problems with bills that are up, feel free to let us know. And the other thing is if you had multiple owners, the way the bill started out, it looked like you had to get permission from all the owners. But so we got some changes there. And if there's a person who's driving and has some ownership interest in it, you only need to get the consent of one of them to get that event data recorder.
HB 155 is something that I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. Paul just mentioned that there seems to be maybe a tug of war a little bit between the state and its perception of its powers versus the powers of the federal government. And HB 155 was directed at that. There is one reason I do want to mention this is that I believe after listening to the committee hearing that the criminal provision that exists in this, and that you'll see that on page 27 toward the bottom. This is a very well put together summary that was done. I didn't do it. I'm not sure who did, but it was very well put together. But it does make a point that there's an amendment that is made now to the impersonation of a law enforcement officer, and it says that can be a Class B misdemeanor if you have somebody that's part of the BLM or fire service, and they actually go out, whether it's on their own land or on state land or county land. It does not matter what kind of land. And some people think, at first blush, maybe this is a turf battle. Oh, let's just make sure they're only doing, you know, enforcing laws on their own land. No, this says that they can't enforce law on their own land either. And after listening to the committee hearing, I'm fairly confident that you will see a citation. And so you need to be aware of the fact that you'll probably have to battle this out in memoranda because somebody's going to get cited.
I need to back up to House Bill 128, driver license suspension modifications. a couple of years ago, the driver's license provisions, frankly, were kind of draconian. They were part of a large alcohol bill that was run at the last minute. And one of the licensing provisions had those who were under 19 years of age having really a long time without a license. And it's very discouraging to kids of that age. And if they were a little older, then they would have the opportunity to work their way out of this suspensions and get them taken care of. In fact, we've had a number of prosecutors ask us about about whether we could get the law to back off on that issue. If kids can turn their life around, you know, that's just great. So it's always a balance how to get them to turn their life around and still have the still having them be responsible for their actions. So essentially what this bill did was change, and this was not our bill, it was the sponsor ran it on his own, but we certainly didn't object to it. we got, when I say we, I'm talking about the DUI subcommittee of USAVE, and together with MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, took a look at these issues and said, no, actually, this is probably a good idea. So we actually supported it instead of saying, no, we've got to just be tougher every minute. This seemed like a good idea. So you can take a look at that if you're concerned about it. If you have any questions at all, you can talk to Kim Gibb, who is the font of all knowledge having anything to do with driver's license. But she will, from this day forward, have an unlisted number. Is that right, Kim? Sorry to do that to you, but I have to acknowledge greatness when we're in the presence. Okay, House Bill 163, Human Trafficking Amendments. Human trafficking, human smuggling, exploiting prostitution, these are all areas of extremely serious concern. We can't go through all of this, essentially, what this did was say, no, there's no statute of limitations for aggravated. That was the first thing, is no statute of limitations for aggravated cases that fall into this area, all of which are first degrees. And the second issue is that knowledge of the of the age of the victim is not a defense to aggravated human trafficking. when, of course, we're talking about a victim who is under the age of 18, that was a very good thing to do. The Attorney General's office was very active in working on this, and I think really did a fine job on it, and which we appreciate. The definition here of a child is a person younger than 18. Now, so when you see child in human trafficking, you're going to normally think of that as being under 14 years of age. The proponents of the interest groups in the anti-human trafficking wanted them called child, by dang. And so no matter whether this was inconsistent with the rest of the things, we kind of wanted them to be called minors just to avoid confusion. But, there you go. Actually in the code there are other places where a child was under 21 and all kinds of bizarre things. So what's one more inconsistent provision, I guess? But it is defined, and so there you have it, and a child is under 18 for those particular purposes. The definition of commercial purposes, you have all of that kind of thing. It also, in order to make the penalties consistent, changed patronizing a prostitute. That doesn't mean you're being disrespectful to a prostitute. It's talking about being a John. And if it involves a child, then it's a third degree. Now, there was one problem, and that is there was also another bill which was run, which had to do with patronizing a prostitute, which added both of these added a subsection 3, and the other one makes it a class A if there are repeat offenses. But what's happened is you have two different subsections 3, which is creating a drafting nightmare, and somehow all of us that looked at it never noticed that we really needed to put in we ended up not having a coordination clause in there. The only thing about it is that both of these that set up a subsection 3 are consistent with each other. So you could put both of them in a subsection 3 without a problem. The question is whether the rules that are guiding alleged counsel will allow them to do that. So I think the jury is probably still out on that issue. And yeah, we'll see what happens. But anyway, that will get corrected in the near future, I'm sure. But that was that human trafficking was a very significant bill. next is House Bill 170. This is talking about DNA collection. There are a whole bunch of things that were added to the kinds of crimes where DNA may be collected at arrest. Okay, at arrest. So the jails need to expand their list. Now already they can collect it violent felonies, and so they have a list, of course, of what the violent felonies are. This expands the list, so you got to get with the jails and explain to them that they've got an expanded list of things that where they can be collecting DNA. Hopefully, the labs at some point will be able to catch up with them and get those all cataloged. But that's a never-ending battle.
Jumping to
page. You got another ditto here.
Yeah, I've got quite a few dittos, and you can see those for yourself. I'm jumping to page 36, HB 229, Criminal Identity Fraud Amendments. It's Representative Oda's bill. This bill was necessary. It came out of a case called State versus Rincon, and what happened in that case is the person had used somebody else's Social Security number by happenstance. In other words, they had made up the Social Security number. And it did belong to some victim who is now a victim of the fact that they've been using their Social Security number. Utah Court of Appeals came back and said, well, that doesn't qualify as the definition of obtaining because he made it up. He didn't obtain it. And so this is a pretty handy fix that happened. One person now commits ID theft when he or she knowingly or intentionally uses or attempts to use the personal identifying information of another, whether that person is alive or deceased, and that's it. You no longer have the obtaining element. We just eliminated it, and I think that solves the problem. HB 232 is a ditto. HB 237 is another ditto, and that gets us to 239.
239 will only be an issue maybe in some of our rural jurisdictions. It adds to the list of of repeat service that is prohibited, and that is if summoned for prospective jury service and the summons is complied with as directed, be selected for qualified jury list more than once. So we're talking about a 2-year period. That may be an issue in some rural areas, so you may want to take a look at that. Because of the concerns that were expressed that the effective date was delayed until January 1st of 2014. So anyway, interesting issue.
Page 40, HB 282 is sexual exploitation of a child. This is a bill that was brought in and fixed by Paul Amon. And you'll see the language there. It comes out of a child pornography case and the need to address what constitutes child pornography in the definition. And so this amended language now includes lascivious exhibition of the buttocks or female breast of a child, which seemed an oversight that wasn't in there in the first place.
It has to be lascivious. It doesn't count baby pictures on a rug.
Has to be lascivious. HB 287, return of weapons recovered by law enforcement. One of the main things to point out, especially if you're familiar with 7610.525, you've generally gone to that section for disposition of weapons after it's been used for court purposes or after it's no longer needed as evidence. That section no longer exists. It's been repealed. And essentially, the language that was there has been put into HB 287, which has also been put into the asset forfeiture bill that we'll talk about in a minute. So we'll wait until we talk about the asset forfeiture bill.
Which is kind of a biggie, so we want to give you some time on that one. HB 295, police officers want to know about this one. Electronic proof of owner's operator security. Somebody can show you their smartphone and say, yeah, here's my proof of owner security when you pull them over. But out of this great concern of big brotherness, you're not free to take their cell phone at that point and look at all their contacts, surf the web, or like them on Facebook. go ahead, Chen.
HB 317 on page 44 is protection of concealed firearm permit information. This actually creates a crime if you share concealed firearm information with a federal agency. Remember earlier we talked about...
No paranoia there.
No paranoia there. That, as much as 10% of Utahns are in a committed gun relationship, well, we want to protect that gun relationship. And so this protects that relationship as it is. You can either be loud and proud, you know, open carry, or you might be more concealed with it. But the important thing is that information cannot be shared with the federal government.
Even your closet relationship.
Exactly. It's terrible. You don't want to let the feds know anything about that. So you can see the penalties there. Do you want to do domestic violence statistics or no?
No.
Okay.
The domestic violence. Where are you?
I'm at 361.
361. These are statistics that have already been gathered, and this just allows CCJJ to put them together and come back to the committee. I guess we didn't need to talk about that. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to spend at least 2 minutes on, maybe a minute and a half, property disposition amendments. This is Lana Taylor's efforts, blood, sweat, and tears on this one.
She's trying to deny it.
And yet, no tears. I'd say no tears, because miraculously, there was a fear going into even doing this bill because it was so big, it covered so many statutes, and it did so many things that really needed to happen. And when you have that coming together, you're generally not, you have to go in with fear that it's not going to work out very well. This one flew under the radar, had no opposition by the legislature, had no opposition by criminal defense attorneys or anything. The summary that's been put together is summary because it needs to be summary. But I want to talk about a couple of the main things that it does that you won't see in the language there. And this is both for law enforcement and prosecutors that may handle asset forfeiture to be aware of. One of those things is that there's a definition now for known address. And that's going to be helpful. Known address is defined as an address provided at the time of the seizure or the most recent record with a government agency at the time the property was seized as provided by the claimant. So in other words, you've got this claimant, property's been seized with them. If they provide an address, that is your known address, so long as you record it as law enforcement. We use that as prosecutors to do our service, and that becomes important. Claimant does not include a person that signed a disclaimer. So if you can get a signed disclaimer to that property, we no longer need to include that person as a claimant. Now, the main thing to think about is what this bill did is it went through the whole code, and anywhere where you had the basis for forfeiture, for example, 5837.13 is actually what renders something forfeitable. And then you go through the procedures in Title 24. Well, this just struck the language in 5837.13 and anywhere else where there was language that made something subject to forfeiture, and instead came up with this definition. Very simple. It says, property used to facilitate the commission of a federal or state offense and any proceeds of criminal activity may be forfeit, period. Doesn't talk about the level of offense, doesn't talk about any specific offense. There's some exceptions below it for automobile homicide and felony DUI, that kind of thing. But otherwise, that's the definition you're going on. And then finally, with regard to the procedures, just think of it this way, 30, 60, 90, 120, something has to happen on each of those. Or 30 is you still need to get that asset seizure notification form to the person whose property was taken. 60, you need to submit it for screening with the prosecutor. So you've got now a full 2 months to submit it for screening. 90, the prosecutor has to get it filed within 90 days of that initial seizure. And 120, the prosecutor needs to have the whole thing both filed and service completed within 120. So 30, 60, 90, 120. Is the thing to remember about that. And then one final point, and this is the surprising thing about how it flew under the radar, is that the case attorney fees have always been capped at 20% for prosecution. But this now caps attorney fees generally at 20% of the value of the property. So I think that would include counsel on the other side as well.
Okay, well, this will come as a surprise, but the Senate also met this year. And they had a couple bills, and I'll just hit one or two that are important to me, and then Chad can get his. First of all,
good news, he's late.
He's not here? Well, you know what they say about justice delayed. We'll just forget he's even here. Okay, Senate Bill 80, removal from the database, restricting firearm purchase. There is a federal database, okay, the National Instant Check System, and folks who get onto that system because of being having been found mentally incompetent in one way or another, get on the system, have a very difficult time in getting off the system. The feds have made a very big deal about this. BCI brought it to everybody's attention. Well, actually, BCI and the courts pretty much put this together because there's a major funding penalty if you don't come up with a way to get them off of the system. So that's what happened. And if the original disability is based on a criminal case, a notice has to be given to the county attorney. So I know that the county attorneys were not excited about having an additional responsibility, and we tried to come up with all kinds of things to do with it, but the federal guidelines pretty much said it had to be the way that it turned out. So there you go, you're going to get notice of this. There is one really bizarre thing in here which I cannot pass up, and that is the last paragraph, well, it's the last paragraph, where it talks about appeals from the district court holds the hearings to decide whether this person is still a risk to society. Okay, and then there is an appeal. If they deny that, there is an appeal to the appellate courts, but it's a de novo appeal. Well, that sounds really bizarre to all of us, because the way that we tend to think of a de novo is that you start the whole trial, the witnesses and everything. We can just see the Court of Appeals doing that. That'd be neat stuff. That's not what a de novo means. What it means is that they will review the record, and all it really means, apparently, is that they give no deference to the trial court, which brings up an important part of my life, which is baseball. And that is when we go to B's games, we go to a lot of them, we have, you know, part of season tickets, and I'm sitting there, there's a close call, and I'm sitting there and I say, bad call, he was safe. And my wife, who was sitting there, says, well, she being a trial court judge, says, you know, this is a difficult call to make. And the umpire was in the best position to make that decision. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh, man. And I'm all worried about it until about four rows back, Greg Orms stands up and yells, I give you no deference, he was out! Oh, I thought it was cute. So anyway, Board of Pardons and Parole, Senate Bill 105, the crimes for threatening them now includes a threat to the family of any member of the board. And since most of them are here, I think that they all feel a little bit better about that anyway. Restitution amendments, Senate Bill 129, this allows the Office of State Debt Collection to use writs of garnishment, which is something they badly need. In fact, the Office of State Debt Collection can use all the help they can get in collecting restitution. It's fairly difficult. Senate Bill 146, driving under the influence, this was a federal regulation that we had to put in the obvious minimum times for electronic monitoring. It was kind of a goofy bill, and I'll tell you the story about that sometime when you have a hard time sleeping. And Senate Bill 228, penalties for specified juvenile offenses. It's big topics, but all it's really doing is codifying Supreme Court. So when you look at these, don't think that it was the legislature just on its own. We're codifying Supreme Court decisions here. First of all, aggravated murder is no longer capital if the defendant was younger than 18 at the time of the commission. LWOP is still on the table because it's not automatic, and the judge it's the jury can make that decision, so that was still constitutional. Life without parole in these non-death cases is now off the table, and that was all in one single bill. So that's obviously an important thing that that we need to know about. And here's a really big one for police officers, and this happens, SB 233, this is a request for emergency medical assistance. Several people are drinking. One of them gets drinks himself under the rug, and all of a sudden there is a medical emergency, and nobody else wants to call because they don't want to be prosecuted for being part of this deal. And and so the bill says that there is immunity from prosecution. That's really not so. If it's an immunity from arresting them or giving them a citation. So theoretically, if somebody calls in and said my friend needs help, we could later file an information charging them with intoxication or providing alcohol or that kind of thing. We probably would not do it anyway, but it's in there. There's also a civil liability piece that says if an officer does not cite or arrest, you don't have, and you act under good faith in that subsection, you don't have any civil liability for what happens after that. What that doesn't tell you is what the heck you're going to do with this drunk person if you can't arrest them. Not citing them is one thing, but what are you going to do with them? I'm sure that you should be able to at least detain them for public safety until somebody can come and get them. And basically that whole thing falls under the holy cow is not responsible for your vehicle exception that was on Steve's sign earlier. Mr. Platt.
Okay, I wanted to hit a couple. And what, if you look at page 60, SB 97, and then the next page has SB 98, and they're both propelling a disgusting bodily substance. This was actually Steve Garside brought these in, but it's important to note when you look at 61, top of page 61, it says amends, that should read enacts. And so this is a new law, both for law enforcement and prosecutors to be aware of. We've always had that it's a crime to, you know, propel these disgusting substances on law enforcement at a correctional officer or a police officer. And this is added infectious agent or vomit or something that contains vomit. But then the new section is that the general public is now protected against this as well, although it's a lower it's a lower crime. It's a Class B misdemeanor unless it's in the face. So if you get saliva, blood, urine, fecal material, infectious material, vomit, you know, maybe a vomit balloon in the face, that's a Class A misdemeanor then at that point, or if the person is an HIV positive or has hepatitis C. So it's good to be aware that that's an entirely new section, and you'll probably see that in your screening. Assault amendments is SB 131 at the top of page 66. Be aware that the structure is a bit different now to assault on a police officer. It's a Class A currently, of course. Upon a second conviction of that section, it becomes a third degree. That remains, but the structure has changed a little bit now. You now have, if it causes substantial bodily injury, that's one way to raise it up. Or if there's a dangerous weapon or other means of force likely to produce death or serious bodily injury, those are helpful additions to bump up an assault on a police officer. And the last one was, I think we already covered patronizing a prostitute amendments.
Yes, we covered it.
I think we did. I always thought it meant when you said, you call that a good time?